So our training facility was next door to the basketball training facility, so we got and watched them practice for a session, threw out a rugby ball, and I can't remember exactly who it was, but one of the guys was obviously joking around, just grabbed the rugby ball and started running up and down the court, and we were like, do these guys ever play rugby? We're out of a job. I'm Chris Wiles, and you're listening to The Rugby Hive.
Today's guest is Chris Wiles. He played 54 times for the USA Eagles from 2007 to 2015, taking part in 3 Rugby World Cups and named Captain America for the 2015 event in England. Wiles represented the USA for 3 years on the HSBC World Rugby 7 Series, blitzing 50 tries in just 13 tournaments. He returned to play sevens and wear the USA jersey at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. He also played over 250 times for Saracens from 2008 to 2018, winning 4 premiership titles and 2 European championships. Following his retirement from the game, he kept his funding alive with Wolfpack Lager. Here is British-American legend Chris Wiles, also known as Shrek.
He's so dangerous, Freddy Krueger has nightmares about him!
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Hive. I'm Dan in Stanford, and despite my South African accent, I was fortunate enough to play rugby for the United States on the Sevens World Series.
And I'm Robin McDougall, a former Canadian Sevens International. Back in my playing days, I went head-to-head against Dallin in the USA.
For several years, Robin has coached international Sevens for various countries, including Canada and Mexico. He's massively passionate about growing the game across the Americas through his McDougall Rugby programs at all levels. I'm currently a commentator for World Rugby, most recently broadcasting the Rugby World Cup in Japan, as well as the amazing Sevens World Series.
More than a decade later, we are teaming up to bring you insights from legendary players and coaches from around the world.
All legends have a story. The Rugby Hive podcast is here to share it.
Welcome to the Hive.
Oh, he's more dangerous than climate change.
Hello and welcome to episode number 18. The time is certainly flying by, and this episode is a brilliant one. Good friend of mine and legend Chris Wiles, former USA Sevens, former 15s Eagle, Premiership Rugby Warhorse with Saracens for well over a decade. I met Chris, affectionately known Shrekie, because he looks like the little monster himself, during the Sevens World Series camps in San Diego back in 2007. We traveled the world for 3 brilliant years, and I'll never forget one of the plane journeys back from Hong Kong. He said to me he not only wanted just to represent the Eagles, he wanted to go to Rugby World Cup for the 15 side. He wanted to play 10 years at the premiership level. He exceeded those goals. Now he's funneling with Wolfpack Lager, a company he founded with fellow Saracen alum Alistair Hargreaves. And Robin, we can't wait to be sponsored and to funnel those here in the US. And I know one of your personal highlights is getting stepped and carved up like a Thanksgiving turkey by Chris.
He's a full package, that guy on the field and off the field. And he's an intelligent guy as well. And that American / British accent, he's got a very cool story and background, how he grew up, he'll dive into in the episode, but just all class. And yeah, I can't wait to sink a few jars with him and you sometime in the near COVID future.
My friend, we also have some other good, exciting news at the Rugby Hive. We have a new addition. Can you give us our listeners an update?
Well, we're both thrilled to welcome Karen Gasparino to the Rugby Hive team. Karen has been involved in rugby for over a decade across North America. She's obviously an avid Toronto Arrows supporter, being based out of the greater Toronto area, but she's a fan of MLR and all teams, both Canada and the US. Obviously, holds Canada a little tighter to the chest like me, but ultimately she wants to see rugby grow in the Americas. Karen and I first connected a few years back as she did a story about my Mexican women and a bit of my coaching journey. And since then, we've been very close, and she's followed all the athletes that have come through in Canada, and even had an opportunity to have her on the McDougall Elite Men's Team of the Vancouver Sevens a couple of years ago. She was on the field, and now she's tracking all those young Canadian boys. But she reached out to us and to get involved, and she wanted to help take our legendary stories and bring them to life. And we featured a couple of those future legends on our intro a few weeks back. The Norston sisters, Christina, who's at Lindenwood Lions in the U.S., as well as Carissa Norston, that is relocated to Vancouver Island, 16 years old, just turned 17 a few days ago, and is already making waves with the training group, with the Olympic women's training group, as well as the World Cup team. So imagine being 16 years old and training with the top group and some of the top athletes in the world for women's rugby. So Karen featured them this week. Just last night, we posted it from Farm to Sea, the Norston sisters' story. And in the next few weeks, we'll be releasing a certain MLR CEO and many other stories from the American side as well. So just a big welcome to Karen Gasparino.
Very exciting to have Karen on the team as well, Robin, as you said. And then listen, more exciting news, keeping in the same vein, Movember is here. Freddie Mercury's back.
Day nine. This is how good it is. It's been a few years and I'm happy to be back on the Mo wagon. Hopefully you'll be rocking it next year. I'll make sure we'll do a big campaign. But if you want to support my Movember cause to bring awareness to men's health, we'll share the link for my Movember page and the Mo will keep growing.
Pal, it is very impressive. It's scary, in fact. You probably will be banned from elementary schools when you're just wandering around there. And Robin, other exciting news, the World 10 Series looked to be absolutely champagne. The location was stunning. The rugby was fantastic. It got better and better, of course, as the games went on. And a shout out to our water buffalo himself, Frankie Horn, one of our earlier guests on the Rugby Hive. A tremendous comeback. Those that didn't see it, tell them what happened.
Well, they had him caged up because of COVID. One of their players didn't get released, so the whole team was quarantined. They just had a little paddock of grass at the back of the resort. I mean, I don't feel too bad for them. They're locked up in paradise. But I had a couple FaceTimes with the big man in the lead up, and they finally were able to break out in the last week. And breakout they did, but what I was most impressed with was just the adversity. Frankie, you know, he had a game plan. His team had a strong culture because they had, you know, they were literally locked in together on site. A bit of an edge for them is they were able to analyze the other teams and pick out their strengths and weaknesses, but also find a game plan that worked for them. But at the end of the day, they had a world-class global seven side and a world-class sevens coach, and the good guys won. So I'm really, really proud of Frankie Horn for leading them and to all those men in that team. What did you think the last day?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was a unique competition where normally you wouldn't even get a chance to be in the championship run, right? If you missed the first tournament and most of the second tournament games as well. But it was really good. The rugby was excellent. What I really enjoyed, I think, about the whole thing also was that, so not only is it a different game, which there's some intricacies which players have then obviously learned over the last few weeks, but it was really cool to see a select professional side playing with each other. So you had the likes of like a Cecil Africa throwing a longbourn to a Collins and Jera from Kenya. So normally those players would go head to head, and here they are on the same team. And that was the same for all the sides. A lot of good Canadian and Americans mixed in there as well. Josh Larson from Canada just kicking a crossfield kick for the corner for the wing. The lock forward just, you know, putting on his number 10 jersey. So things like that, I think, were really cool and really impressive, and it was just fun to watch rugby again, right?
What did you think of the bonus kick?
Conversion jeopardy, I thought, was an interesting one. I would prefer to have more try scoring incentives than kicking incentives, but I did think it was kind of cool that if you were down by 1 to 5 points, you could have the equivalent of that kick to win it. I did like Bram van Straaten at 49 years of age coming onto the field. The manager, I don't quite know how the squad lists work, but his name obviously was on the list. He came on just for that and kicked the winning kick from the halfway line, which that was pretty cool. I mean, how many times you have a 49-year-old carving up professional rugby?
We need a Rugby Hive team next year, and Johnny Wilkinson is going to be on the bench, and we'll just pull him out. Left foot, right foot. But shout out to Matthew Turner as well. He went into like 18 overtimes to get it done. I was so impressed that a guy that doesn't really kick for goal in 15s.
Matty Turner, the Sea Wolf, the Tiger rugby legend as well, the Kitchen Mouse, he was on fire. He can do it all. He really is a professional.
All he needs is a mustache.
Exactly. So let's crack on with it and let's bring that support in for the Rugby Hive, brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels.
Get 20% off and free shipping with the code RugbyHive at manscaped.com.
That's right. That's 20% off free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code RugbyHive. Your balls will thank you. Your stash will thank you. Your body will thank you. We also want to thank our legendary partners that have been with us from day one, Gilbert Rugby Canada, Brand Marinade and Focus Care Products. You hit us up on all the socials at Rugby Hive on Twitter and Facebook, at My Rugby Hive on Instagram. It's time now for episode number 18. An extremely special guest, Chris Wiles, my friend. The viewers there can't see it right now, but you're sporting a brilliant mustache. How are things going for you, my friend?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Going well. Surviving, trying to keep as busy as possible in these slightly strange times, and hence the moustache.
Well, we're going to put some stuff on the social media as well. Very Freddie Mercury-esque. Been doing any singing with your little ones?
No, mate, no singing. You don't want to hear me sing. In fact, you probably have heard me sing. It's terrible.
Yeah, well, can't be worse than me. Verity's the only one in the family that can sing. And so, Paul, let's go here. You were born in Stamford, Connecticut. Okay. Do you remember anything about growing up in the US? You were there for probably, the first 10 or 11 years of your life. And how did that circumstance come about?
I remember very vividly my childhood in the US. I left in just before 96. So we had some, and I was born in 83, so I had some good years there. The majority of my time was in a town called Allentown in Pennsylvania. So it's pretty suburban, lots of space. I remember it being an amazing childhood filled with sport and activity. And I say that just because when you come to England, it's an island essentially, it's much smaller, less space. So that was the kind of thing that really struck me when I came over here to the UK. And funny enough, I've been recently watching The Last Dance, which I'm sure everyone has. And that really brought back all the memories, because those years, early 90s, when I was, in my, 8, 9, 10, 11, just watching basketball, wearing all the Bulls gear and following all the different players. I remember Sean Kemp and the Supersonics, all these different names. So it's brought back some memories. But yeah, very vivid, actually. It's not, and it came about because my dad was working there for a business called Binney & Smith. The reason we moved back to the UK is they wanted to bring him back over to Europe. So that's why we left the US.
And tell us about some of your other sporting endeavors. You wore basketball tops, but did you play basketball? What other sports did you play growing up?
Yeah, funny enough, the main sport I focused, if you could call it a focus at that age, was football on the East Coast. Every weekend, going to play different soccer tournaments, played for my local team, Schnecksville. Probably wasn't even my dad's influence necessarily, it was the game that I just picked up and really ran with. But that being said, played T-ball, loved basketball. My brother's 6'4", basically taller, better looking version of me, which isn't hard. And he killed it on the basketball court. So I always just tried to emulate him. Men's lacrosse actually got into that a little bit, which you mentioned lacrosse over here. Typically in the UK, they don't really understand the men's game, which is, I loved playing it because it's really tough on the fitness, but you get to whack people. So probably set me up nicely for rugby. Yeah, so there were a lot of sports kicking around, but really loved playing soccer. Frustratingly, never really got to play football with pads. It was only, I think if I'd stayed another year, I would have been able to start playing proper football. So never got to play that.
US rugby was probably very happy that you didn't get into football, because you had a legendary rugby career. Tell us about your education. You studied politics at the University of Nottingham.
It was a pretty tough degree. I knew it at the time that I was, in my head, I was trying to focus on rugby, but my dad made me stick with the degree, and I'm really thankful for that, because it was a really enjoyable experience. I think rugby players now, becoming more professional, don't get to have these life experiences. So whilst I was able to fulfill the professional career, I think being able to go to university for 4 years, get to experience the studying, obviously making friends and everything that comes with it, was a vital part of my development, really. And I think kept me grounded when I did eventually get into rugby, because I'd had that experience. I have to admit, the degree was tough. I wasn't quite ready for how difficult I found it. Lots of reading and lots of analysis, but eventually got there in the end. So yeah, very, very thankful I stuck with that. Thanks to my dad, actually.
And Chris, your first professional rugby contract was signed in 2006 with Nottingham RFC, but a lot changed for you over the next 12 months, particularly in 2007. Can you talk us through how that came about and your journey in the short space of time?
Without trying to go on a huge rant, from school, went to Nottingham and had 2 years at Leicester Tigers Academy. And the interesting part there was that Dan Lyle was there. And I remember it vividly. I was walking around and didn't get to interact much with the first team because we were on different training schedules. I was just there doing Tuesday, Thursday evenings. But I remember seeing Martin Johnson and Dan Lyle, and I was like, I recognized Martin first, obviously, because at the time he was so well known. But then I just looked at Dan Lyle and I was like, geez, this guy's huge. He was huge. I just remember that. Anyway, so then went on to Nottingham. Left Nottingham, went and played my first, I'd call it my first full-time professional contract at Northampton. And unfortunately, things didn't go really to plan. Strangely enough, I was in the England Sevens wider squad. And if I had played an England Sevens game, I wouldn't have been eligible for the US. But because the season didn't go quite to plan, Northampton got relegated. And I didn't actually feature on any of the England Sevens tours because there were so many injuries at Northampton. The US got in contact before the 2000 World Cup and said, would you be interested in trying to have a crack at playing in the World Cup team? Which, as we discussed the other night, allowed me first to have a go at the Sevens in Hong Kong, which very fortunately managed to get involved in the US Sevens setup as well.
And so what was it like? Because as you said, you were in the England training squad and you'd spent most of your life in England. What was it like representing the US Eagles at that 2007 World Cup instead of England?
It was actually pretty amazing because I've said this before. At the end of that Northampton contract, I was almost ready to give up playing professional rugby. I had found it was a very difficult year, and I thought to myself, I'm probably better suited going out and finding a job. When the US came and gave me the opportunity, obviously I jumped at it, and then it was just so refreshing going into a different rugby environment, meeting a great group of people. One of the things I really noticed about US rugby, which I think is, you know, probably the same with Canada rugby, is particularly at that time, there was no real professional structures or setup. And so it was just this feeling of everyone in it. You know, Mike Petrie, I just quickly deviate, I always remember Mike Petrie having to play the All Blacks in November 2014. The week before, he was plumbing. Then the next week, he's having to play the All Blacks. It's that kind of attitude of everyone's in it together. We know we're up against it. But it just created this awesome environment of, you know, lifelong friends and lifelong memories. And it was obviously difficult because you were going into these games underpowered, but it still kind of brought this camaraderie I found that was really powerful.
So would you say that we collectively revived your career, if you will? Because you started with the Sevens and we had some good laughs on tour and we had some great, great moments on the field.
Yeah, I mean, Sevens, it really, I mean, that first trip in Hong Kong, the whole Sevens tour, that then obviously pre and post World Cup, 100% rejuvenated my career. And I'm so thankful to USA Rugby and the opportunity it gave me. I think it would have been a different story had I not been able to get involved. And the Sevens was just, you know, we've talked about that the other night. I mean, those are some of the best memories, I think, certainly of my career, of the people I've met, where we got to visit. And I think the thing with the Sevens, what struck me is that, and again, this is probably a similar story with Canada, is I think it was at a point where we were both trying to become competitive in that Sevens environment, and it was almost there. It's easier to become competitive in the Sevens environment than as a 15s. There's so many more complexities. So that I found really awesome as well, that we were fighting this fight to become a competitive Sevens team. And every time we beat, you know, we beat a Samoa, or we got closer to South Africa, or don't think we ever beat Fiji in our time, but we started pulling off these wins, and it was awesome.
Yeah, no, we did. That era was Fiji. Justin Boyd scored. I don't know if you were on that trip, but in Wellington.
Yes. Sorry, yes, I was on that trip. That's right. Chris, yeah, we beat Fiji.
And to remind you as well, you scored the winner against England, which was our first time beating England in I don't know if it was history, yeah, but you scored in that one. We beat Australia. The only teams that era didn't win against was New Zealand and South Africa, if correct.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. No, it's a good days, though. Good moments.
What did you think of his gloves that he wore?
Come on.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, we could spend this whole podcast talking about Dallin Stanford and his quirks.
In a way, ahead of time, right? I mean, you know, people wearing gloves now. I know it's a terrible situation we're in, but you should pull them out, actually.
Yeah, you should. When did you actually officially retire the gloves? Were you still playing with gloves? You finished your career wearing gloves, basically. Is that right?
Unfortunately. And I look back a lot of photos. Like a friend of mine, Brent Russell, played for the Springboks, and he had gloves, and he gave me a bunch of them. Then I see photos of people posting of that era of one or two South African players wearing them. And it was a thing back then. Honestly, it was. But I don't know why I wore them. I should never have worn them. And yes, I wore them the whole time. I need to do some photoshopping edits on them.
But to give you credit, like, it wasn't like you had good hands. You didn't need gloves, man. That was like, that's probably your one skill set. I wouldn't say your speed or your strength.
No. Never seen.
Maybe that's why, though. Maybe that's why. More guys should have worn them.
Yeah, exactly. The gloves, the nerdness, the cleanliness, the speed, Chris, of his talking.
Chris, this episode is about you. We'll get into your nickname, okay, while we call you the Shrek later. Sorry. Robin, back to you.
Sorry,
I'm just dying over here. So just to change gears here, we had Todd Cleaver on the Rugby Hive the other day, and he took us through the Taku Nwenga try. I hope I said it right there, Dallin.
Nope, you didn't.
Nguenya.
And it's Todd Clever, but that's Robin. This is fine. We want to go back and forth.
I'm a rugby coach. So, what were your memories from that World Cup try of the year?
So, first quick story on that was Taku came into the squad late because we had an injury to our fullback, South African guy Dallin, that you would have played many times with.
Yeah, Francois Fillon, right?
Francois Fillon. Fortunately, he got injured right before the World Cup, which gave a shift in the squad a little bit. I think Taku would have joined anyway, but I suppose I'm going to this point because I think it's such a fascinating story. So he gets in the squad, he hasn't played huge amounts of rugby, we do some warm-up games, and, you know, we can all see that he's got this raw pace and a phenomenal athlete. And then he just starts layering on the ability to understand rugby, and he does that really quickly. But still, by the time he got to the World Cup, and I think he wouldn't mind me saying this, he hadn't, you know, he was very raw in terms of his rugby ability. We had played a warm-up game in Aspen, Colorado, where I was against him on the wing, and he handed me off and made me look like an absolute idiot, rounded me like a parked car, as Damon would say. So I knew what his handoff was like and his pace. And then, if you remember, he scored a really good try against Samoa where he handed off Alassane Tuilagi and ran in. So people were taking notice at this point already. And I just felt before, and it's easy to say now, I just felt before that game, something was going to happen. And even, I remember like a few guys saying to Tatu, like, this is, you know, he's against Sabana on the wing. It felt like there was something bubbling with him. You know, you give him the ball and something was going to happen. And then the actual try itself, all I remember was trying to catch up to Todd and to anyone. I couldn't catch up to anyone. Todd handing off, I think it was Butch James, and then Alec Parker getting the ball, chucking it to Hercules. Hercules throwing this like absolute doozy over the top to him, and Gwenya were like, right, okay, maybe if I get set up for the next phase, I might get the ball because I'm just running around like a nutcase, not doing anything. And then he scores this on the pitch. I think you do understand the significance of it, but like now looking back on it, Tatu went on to play over 250 games for Bayreuth. He became this really well-rounded rugby player. There's a hat-trick that he scores against Ospreys, which includes a handoff, you know, his typical handoff from pace, a chip over the top and a regather, and then some like good handling exchange. The significance of that try, I think, you look back on it, to go ahead and have the career he did and do all the things he did, it's huge. I mean, you have to say it's probably one of the best tries in the World Cup, in any World Cup. Given, and also remember this guy, again, I hope I got this correct. I think he won a green card lottery to come over to the US.
Remarkable, the story. And when I first met him in the Sevens program, you know, he was okay, right? You looked at him, you're like, oh, he's got potential. He can do a couple of swerves. And then the way he elevated himself, as you said, and became such an all-round player. And a lot of players sometimes at that moment, they do something iconic and that's what they're remembered for and that's it. But you're right, that was the start of his journey.
That's just a really good point. Like, they get remembered for that one try. Particularly in the teams that aren't winning World Cup games, you know, players can have their moment. Just saw recently on social media, they showed his try against Scarlets in the European semi, who went the length of the pitch. Sensational career, really.
I think sometimes from a coaching aspect, we complicate the game. Sometimes it's just like, give it to the big guy, give it to the super fast guy more often, you know? Yeah. We got all these fancy plays, but let's just give it to the athletes and let them do their thing.
We had that with Samu Manoa. Give Samu the ball and give it to him as quickly as possible.
Just going back to that 07 World Cup, that was a huge tournament for you, so much that Eddie Jones, who was on the Springboks coaching staff, signed you with the Saracens later on when he became director of rugby in 2008. What was your initial impressions of the Saracens setup?
Initially, the reason I joined, first and foremost, is because Eddie reached out. My name was sort of kicking around a few different clubs. The idea was maybe he could come on trial. Yeah, Chris, we'll have him. Whereas Eddie replied to my agent and said, no, I looked at Chris, I've watched him in the four World Cup games in a very Eddie Jones style. But, no, I've done my analysis, I've watched him play, and I think he can contribute to the team. So by the time he'd said that, I thought, right, well, this is the opportunity I need to go for. This kind of coach who's actually, who backs me and who's seen me play is obviously very thorough. But when I got to Saracens, that was 2008, and that was the tail end of the era where there was a mid-table performing team and didn't really know who they were or what they stood for. So to be quite honest with you, in that first year, it was just a case of keeping my head down, working as hard as I could and hoping that they would sign me for, you know, another contract. And then everything changed.
I was going to say, so you spent a decade there, play over 250 games. Your resume includes four premiership titles, two European Championship Cup titles, and amongst other personal highlights. So looking back on that career, can you list a couple of favourite moments that stand out to you in a Saracens jersey?
On the playing side, the first premiership title that we won was a huge sort of feather in our cap in terms of what we were trying to create as a culture and as a club. And that was a huge, almost relief, but it was one of those massive moments. And I'll never forget that, playing at outside centre in the final against Leicester with Brad Barrett, inside centre, who's a good mate of mine, final whistle going, and just that like sheer joy. Winning the European Cup for the first time was similar to the premiership final. You know, we'd won the premiership and then we'd gone on this journey trying to then become a squad that could compete both in the premiership and in Europe. And at that time, it was all the big French teams who had huge packs, phenomenal athletes, and we just couldn't quite beat them. I remember one year, Clermont just made us look like kids in a quarterfinal at Vicarage Road. So when we finally got to the point that we won Europe, that was again another like huge milestone for the club. But a lot of the memories, actually, plenty has been spoken about this, is our trips and the way that we bonded. There was a period where we were going to Miami, we went to Beer Fest together. All those moments that you have sharing beers with the guys outside of the training ground were fantastic. But there was one particular moment that we got taken skiing in Verbier, and we're all at the top of the slopes in our skis, middle of the season. And as you might know, skiing within a rugby contract is essentially a breach of contract. But we'd been taken by the club to go skiing. So there with all your mates, all, you know, 40 odd of us, skiing down the slope to go and get a beer. It was like, this isn't real life. This is just amazing. And funny enough that, you know, the method and the madness there was that we would get to understand each other better, get to know each other better, and have these shared moments outside of rugby, so that when it came to making that last ditch tackle or getting up into the line that little bit quicker, you would do it because you'd had these shared moments and you'd built these relationships. Two on-pitch moments, but certainly being in Verbier in the middle of the Alps skiing, it is right up there for sure.
Yeah, it's all about connecting off the field and making those lifelong friendships. So we'll get to your involvement after the game in a second. But Saracens led the way for many years investing in their players' futures. Can you comment on that, you know, throughout your career? Were their programs set up by Saracens, and what would you say about that?
Obviously, the elephant in the room is the recent salary cap issues of Saracens. Just commenting on that really quickly, that the fact is a lot of what Saracens put in place and the culture they created has got nothing to do with salary cap issues. I think that's, whilst I don't think everything that happened at Saracens was 100% perfect, I certainly believe a lot of what was created didn't require huge amounts of money. One of the big things I think they were able to do was encourage players to look after themselves for life after sport. And that isn't investing, it's investing in their time. So it's investing in studying, it's investing in looking at players' well-being mentally, and generally pushing players to explore what's out there outside of rugby. And I think they were the Saracens, certainly in England, were the trailblazing club in that regard. And for us, that led Al and I to, you know, before Al joined the club, Alistair Hargreaves, he'd just come from Durban. He met me at a time where I'd had about 3 or 4 years worth of working with one of our sports psychologists and head of PDP, as we call it, personal development program, who'd been pushing me to try internships, to explore further studying, to really just to continue to see what was out there in terms of the workplace. And when Al joined, we were in the perfect position to say, hey, let's do something together. I've tried to do these various things and you've come over and you've got an entrepreneurial interest. Let's join forces and become business partners.
Can you tell us a little more about starting the Wolfpack?
Led by the great work that Saracens were doing, we said, I was actually planning on doing an MBA, and Al had just moved to London and he was looking at different internships. And we thought, you know what, rather than getting back into books, let's learn by doing. So he said, let's start a business. Let's literally start a business straight away and make failures and not have that fear of failure, because at the end of the day, we just want to learn different aspects of business and what it takes to start up. Fortunately for us, when we started the business, we'd always meet for coffees, and coffees always turned to beers. And we were always like, okay, this is a sign, let's do something in beer. So we started a beer business. We converted a double-decker bus and parked it on the side of the stadium and sold our first lager from the double-decker bus. And the first game was the first home game in September 2014, and it had a great reaction. We sold a load of beers and we were like, I think we're onto something here. So things just progressed nicely. For the remaining kind of 2-3 years of Alistair's career, when we were both, before he retired, we were just diligent. We tried as best as we could every day off to approach the business as professionally as possible and learn as much as we could in the industry. And we were both motivated. And as I said earlier, we weren't scared of failure. We saw that as part of the process, which I think ultimately put us in a good place to succeed in certain areas.
The beer industry is one of the most competitive in the world. I had 9 years with it myself, both from a large brewery and as well as a craft brewery as well. What were some of your biggest challenges that you've had to overcome?
On the industry side of things, it's really cutting through the amount of products that are now out there. You know, we focus on lager products, and in 2014, perhaps we were one of the few that had done that in England, or at least in London. And so it's really kind of trying to cut through the white noise of all the different products and offerings. So we had to make sure that we were unique. And I think the great thing was that we were still playing for Saracens and we were professional sportsmen. So our story was very different to other craft breweries. And then, as you say, on the bigger scale of things, big breweries just have such a strong hold on the industry from their massive listing fees to their just sheer power and size. So it's kind of making sure once you get on tap, and I'm sure there's everything you know you've dealt with for many years, as you say, it's making sure getting on tap is one thing, and then having the consumers want to, it's the pull through, is people actually understanding what your beer is about and being able to keep that rate of sale. But we're now in a position where we own two bars and we have two different styles of beer, so we're operating on both the distribution side and the retail side. It allows us to learn lessons from both sides, and the reason we moved into the retail side is we saw what we could achieve on the retail margins with our bus. You know, as you know, delivering kegs is a high volume, low profit game, so we wanted to also get involved in, and for us, having bars is also a way of allowing us to kind of talk about our brand and what we stand for. And it's like the home of Wolfpack. Actually, Dan's been there. You've been there to Queen's Park.
Oh, loved it. It was great. In fact, I'm one of the only people in America that has one of your pint mugs with the cool logo. And again, that was gifted to me, I think. I don't know. But let's talk about that. Your branding is on point. Your logos are awesome. You also have this amazing Wolfpack truck called The Beast. I've seen some social media. You personally have delivered back in the day some kegs and stuff like that. Tell us about that. I mean, it's pretty epic.
Tell them it was like this. We had the bus. The Wolfpack bus, we poured beers from the bus. That was successful. Like, great, that's awesome. We then wanted to replicate that experience easily outside of the stadium. We thought, well, how can we do this? We need something mobile. So we bought this Land Rover Defender, and we just put taps on the side of it. And that can go to weddings, to events. And we can deliver kegs from it. So that became the next extension of the brand, where we felt we could have an impact. And then we started pouring our beers into the on-trade in and around Northwest London. And so then naturally we thought, well, how can we, what's next? And we thought, well, we need a bar. We need a home that is everything that we stand for. And that's where Wolfpack Queen's Park was born. And so that's kind of what takes us today. But yeah, The Beast is awesome. And it's great fun when you take that to events as well, because everyone stops, comes by, asks about the story. Obviously, 15 beers deep, and you can tell the story pretty well. So it's a great asset for us to have.
Well, I will say rugby and, you know, having a drink with friends go hand in hand. So it's such a brilliant idea, and you guys executed it very well, which is important. Let's go back to rugby for a second. You and I played together for the Sevens Eagles 2007 to 2009. Robin played against us for a little bit for Canada. Firstly, let's go to your nickname, Shrek.
What are you, I mean, you're probably best. You gave me the name. What you sum it up for me.
Well, basically, you on the field embodied a monster. Nobody could stop you. You just bolstered people out the way. And then you're just such a chiseled jaw. You look exactly like Shrek, the monster, but in a friendly monster, you know. And your missus is Princess Fiona. So it really stuck, is what I would say.
Let me tell you this to anyone who's actually listening. He never said the first bit to me ever. It was only ever the fact I looked like a horrible green monster.
Which, by the way, our coach at the time, Al Caravelli, got the Shrek monsters for us, and that was our he toured with us for many, many years.
Yeah, he became a team mascot, basically.
Team mascot, if you will. Yeah, I know. Anyway, but flick back to those memories of your Sevens days with the US and talk a bit about that if you can.
The fact that you're traveling to these amazing parts of the world with a small... One of the things I really enjoy about Sevens is the small groups. I find that the groups are really manageable, and you can create such a great environment. Typically, a touring... And I'm probably a little bit off now, but when we were touring, it would be about 13.
Only 12, no, 12 members of the squad, players. We didn't take any extra reserves. Yeah, you're right. And then the staff was bare bones as well. So you're right, close group.
But yeah, so just really, really tight groups, amazing places to go and play, you know, Hong Kong, Wellington, Dubai. I mean, these are all just incredible places to play. And then for us personally, I think being on this kind of campaign of putting US Sevens back on the map, it was something really powerful for us to latch onto. And as I said, I just remember every step of the way as we continue to perform and get better and start winning more games. It was such an awesome experience, I think, for all of us. And it defined our career, I believe. Sorry, not defined our career, but I mean, it was the kickstarter to a lot of our careers. But it obviously had its ridiculous moments. You know, the idea of, like, I think the hardest moments were having to travel in between tournaments. I remember our first ever Dubai tournament, we went 0-5, and we're in the airport with everyone, probably just staring at us going, you know, how ridiculous are these blokes, went 0-5 in Dubai, and then you have to hack around the airport, no one knows, we're back, bags are getting lost, you're running around doing weird stuff, playing cards and cleaning things, everyone's all over the place, you get held up, you're on a really bumpy flight, and I don't know where we go from there, we go to...
South Africa, we went to George, right?
George. And actually, that's why I say bumpy flight, because I had to catch some internal flight to George. I thought I was going to die on the plane. There were moments where, like, it'd be nice just to be sitting at home, but ultimately, yeah, just unbelievable. What about you, Robin? Do you remember playing? Did we ever play? I can't remember we had that many battles, Canada and US. There was a few.
The first time I played the US for me was in Hong Kong. I'm not sure what year, but I did do the Dubai and then the George trip a couple times. Yeah. And I remember just being, my first time I was completely exhausted coming back from George. I lost some teeth against Wales in Dubai. So I had some temporary teeth in George, and then I broke my thumb in George. So I was just a mess my first tour, but I was so happy, and we'd gone all right. Before we boarded the flight from George to Joburg, we all of a sudden had a 17-hour layover. So we had a 17-hour layover before we caught a 45-minute flight to Joburg, and then it's like 8-9 hours to Dubai, and then 8 to 10 hours to London, and then 5 to 8 hours to Toronto, and then Toronto to Vancouver, then Vancouver to Vancouver Island. So it was 58 hours, my first trip home, 58 hours. And I remember just being numb. And, you know, and we talk about with some of our guests so far, it's amazing. You do this, you do that, but you know what? It's a war of attrition. And like you say, after playing 5-6 games the first week and then having to travel and then do it again the next week. And for me mentally, I guess you just can't describe it, but I don't know how you guys felt your first sevens international, but you know, when you prepare for a game, you know, and then you go through the review after the game, you're going to play 5 or 6 different international games in 2 days. So even though you're tired and you've spat out teeth and you've got a broken thumb and you're exhausted and your legs are dying, you have to get yourself up because you have a full international match that's going to be televised around the world. You can't let your team down. So that was the ultimate for me and everybody that was on that traveling circus, was just being able to get up and go, and just that warrior spirit. But you know, the being a good tourist and learning how to travel was 90% of the battle.
I have to say that what you bring up there is that it is really a on the one hand, it is phenomenal traveling with your friends, seeing these amazing places, playing in front of huge crowds, the TV, the try, scoring tries, all the glory around sevens is definitely there. But alongside that is definitely, you know, all of the difficult moments that you have to really grind it out. And people probably don't really appreciate that. You know, you're losing games or, yeah, you're injured, then you have to get yourself back up and play against Fiji. You know, you've got no teeth like you, and you're coming up against, you know, some Fijian beasts to travel in between. The mental side of it, actually, I think, like, talk about, you know, mental toughness. I think being on a sevens tour can get pretty tough pretty quickly. I mean, I always thought maybe it was a young man's game, and I think for the most part it is, but hats off to a lot of the guys in the past sort of 6-7 years who've probably kind of focused in on sevens, and they do that year in, year out.
On that, just going back to that layover in George, looking at Wazeli Serevi, that was a coach player at the time, and I mean, he was probably then the age I am now, around 40, and he was still playing. And I was just trying to think in my head, and I definitely idolized then and still do, but I remember just looking at him going, I wonder how many planes that guy's been on. And yeah, he was just so chill the whole time, even though, like, for him, you know, he's never, never, never at home. And then fast forward, as far as it being a young man's game, I'm way better at it now. I mean, I still do it. You guys still do it on the road. Myself as a coach, and I get young athletes into the program, and everything's new, and everything's, and they're stressed out because they're not used to being away, or they're not used to their flight being on time, or, you know, you just get used to dealing with adversity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you fast forward to now with this COVID thing, and we're all adapting. Well, I think those that have been on the World 7 Series or just been in any kind of international sport and in stressful times and been to these different kinds of, we probably have better coping skills, I think, because of it. So I'm trying to use some of those skills to help some of my athletes and younger coaches navigate as well.
One thing I'd add to that is both what you guys bring up as well. I'll never forget waking up on a Sunday or the day 2 of a tournament and being like, oh, we've got to do this all again, right? But now as a commentator going to these events, it's a dream, because that day is actually the most exciting day as a commentator, because you get to do the quarters and the semifinals and the knockouts. So it's quite a little switch. You're not waking up battered and bruised and your body's not messed up, you know. You're having cups of tea to get your voice ready, but it's a completely different setup, which is great.
Yeah, that must be really awesome, actually, following the circuit and not having to be a player.
Exactly.
You get to really delve into the whole excitement of it.
So just jumping up to 2016 Olympic Games, you came back to play sevens. What was that journey like for you?
It was really tough to try and get myself in shape and to be in a position to compete. But I have to say that the coming into the group that I was going into with Light Friday leading the charge and players like led by Madison and all these guys, just phenomenal players. So I had to really step up. It was a little bit disappointing in terms of where we finished. And I always look back and reflect on it and wish I could have done more. Could I have done something slightly differently in terms of my own input? But, you know, it's tough because these games, as we all know, sevens, it's such small margins. And the first game we played against Argentina, it was a bounce of a ball, I think, basically, that led to an Argentinian try, which kind of set the tone for the tournament for us. But it was, in terms of an experience, being part of Team USA, getting to even fight for a spot in that sevens group, getting to see guys like Perry and Carlin train and play up close and personal, get to spend time with Mike Friday's coaching and really understand what they're building there and what they've been able to achieve was awesome. And then obviously ending up in Rio and being surrounded by all these ridiculous athletes. I remember going to the opening ceremony and just walking along, and in front of me, I was like, geez, these guys are big, who are they? And it was the basketball team, just like spotting, you know, all these different guys. Like, this is ridiculous. So there's some really surreal moments in that and really amazing, fun memories. I just, you know, as I said, like the competitive side of me thinks the squad was in a position to be able to medal, I think. And that's a big statement, but I think they had the quality of players to medal.
And Chris, full circle though, would you say as a youngster growing up in America, watching the basketball players, and there you are at the Olympic Games next to some of them?
It's crazy, yeah. One day I was sitting in the cafeteria and Serena Williams just sits next to Colin and starts having a chat. We're like, this is just crazy. This is awesome. Like, and then, yeah, so it's full circle. We also went out and watched our training facility was next door to the basketball training facility. So we got and watched them practice for a session, threw out a rugby ball. And I can't remember exactly who it was, but one of the guys was obviously joking around, just grabbed the rugby ball and started running up and down the court. And we were like, do these guys ever play rugby? We're out of a job. But yeah, I mean, it was a really special time.
So now switching gears back to 15s, 3 World Cups, 54 times capped for the US. Can you give us your insight into that 8-year journey, particularly you played professional rugby with the Saracens and then being available then to travel with the US, you know, how was it balancing all that?
Yeah, it was tough, but I think going back to my first point is I always found the group environment in USA rugby amongst the boys in the squad was always phenomenal because it was guys really just we were fighting for each other and things weren't always perfect, far from it, but, you know, lifelong friends and fantastic memories. But I think from my personal experience, it was tough going from the Saracens organization where things were very professional and there was a certain quality to then trying to jump into the US. And that was the reality of the situation. Yeah, I mentioned someone like Mike Petrie having to work the week before he then plays against the All Blacks. It's huge challenges in that. Just fantastic memories. Always wish we were more competitive. That's the reality. Played 3 World Cups and only won one game against Russia. And I'd love to have been in a position to win more games with the US. You know, I think we're all aware of the challenges.
Yeah, speaking of the challenges, you know, I've kept in touch about Major League Rugby and about how the game is growing here in the States. Would you like to get involved in that sort of aspect of the game here in the US at some point?
Yeah, I think I always feel very indebted to my career to the US. There's a huge part of me that would love to come back one day. And I don't know when it will be and I don't know in what guise, but to come back and contribute. And I really want to be able to come back and contribute in a tangible way, in a way that really does help. Hopefully in the future that comes about, an opportunity does come about because, yeah, as I say, I feel very indebted to the game in the US. I hope that, obviously there are some tough times at USA Rugby at the moment, but I do hope that with the MLR and with Sevens, the Olympics, things can continue to develop and grow.
As much as you'd like to have more success with the US, one thing that's for sure is you're a big part of the movement and where they are today. And we had a couple of former Canadian captains on earlier last week, the Moonlight Cousins, and older cousin Dave led the way for so many years. The problem is he was our only good player and we couldn't keep up with him to watch him score tries. But his younger cousin, 8 years younger cousin, John Moonlight, went on to help Canada lift a cup. And, you know, pioneers like yourself that have fought their way through and balance, you know, your professional career with your Eagles career have laid the groundwork for the Carlins and the Perrys and the Madisons now. So you should be very proud of that. And, you know, before we let you go, just want to ask what your advice would be for the next generation of aspiring rugby players out there listening.
I think one of the big things that probably doesn't get talked about enough potential in rugby is the basics. There's a feeling sometimes, I think, to get concerned about some of these big plays and get influenced by seeing the end product. But for me, it's all about the basics. And that's really maybe where a large part of the focus should be in North America, is making sure that the coaches are zeroed in, and the coaches are right. You know, they understand the game better than anyone, and putting that emphasis on making sure that they're teaching these young guys the good solid basics. If you've got the basics nailed down and you layer a work ethic on top of that, then I think you can achieve a great deal in rugby. Of course, there's always going to be space for the mercurial players and your fantastic wingers and you know, the Carlos Spencers at 10s and players like this. But I think there's a great deal of athletes who I think can have a huge impact on the game by doing the basics really well and having a phenomenal work rate.
Well, Chris, that's great advice for the next generation. And it's been an honor to play alongside you over a few years and see your journey go through. I'll never forget being on a plane ride with you, one of those long journeys to Africa somewhere. And you said to me in 2007, you're like, I want to play for a decade at least at a top club and put my work on the field. And you certainly did that. You did more than that, my friend. I can't wait to share Wolfpack with you. We'll get Robin over to the UK as well. That'll be legendary, my friend.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. Been enjoying chatting. Cheers. Thanks, guys. Thanks for your time.
Beautiful ball over the top. Yes, Seppo!
Thank you for listening, you sleek sensations.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Rugby Hive Podcast and catch us on all the socials at Rugby Hive.
We appreciate your support. Be safe out there, and we'll see you soon.
They've taken the lunch money from South Africa, and are up by 17.